Session number 3966, reel number 5.
Mr. Milne, take number 5. What was your life? What form did your life take on the outstation?
Yes, that was, again, very much an individual thing. We had a tennis court, which was very good. It had been dug out of the bush, as one would say. There was just, a district officer, the two officers, myself, and the doctor when he was in station. So generally, we were well and truly occupied as far as the military side was concerned. I was fully occupied with admin duties, all the clerical work, ranging for pay parades and stores. There was plenty to do from that side. It was only in the evening that one was really free. In the afternoon, although there was no parades in the afternoon because it was usually very hot and sticky, that was the time I did all the clerical work. But then in the evening, it was tennis. That was our main thing. And then at night time, you were either invited to the district officer's house or the company commander's house. And this is where I then learned that bridge was an essential part of being one of your qualifications for outstations. So in this case, I was able to make up a 4 for bridge. So usually in the evening we had music and bridge evenings. We didn't play for money from that point of view, but it was just a question of filling in the time and playing bridge. Again, of course, it was very interesting because the district officer was a most interesting man. He would tell us all the things that were going to happen, what he was doing, going out to visit this and so on, and problems that he had. And there we are. But this wasn't good as long for me. Within about, I think it was a month, 6 weeks, I was posted to India, which was the depot of the Nigeria regiment. The company commander got the shock of his life because it was never been heard of before, because any officer or NCO, BNCO, that went to Zaria, to the depot, had to be on his second tour and also had to have passed the language test. And there was me, as a complete youngster, being posted to Zaria. Much to my amazement, much to everybody's amazement.
Did you find out why you were posted?
Well, it was understandable because, A, I'd just left my depot. I'd been 2 years as an instructor in the depot. And, of course, by this time, the powers that be in headquarters had discovered my qualifications. The year before, I'd been to Hythe and got a 1 in weapon training and all this sort of thing. And to them, it was ideal that there was an instructor, I suppose, but I didn't know at the time, and I couldn't understand why, but I was posted to Zaria, which was the depot. And I had to pack up this life that I was just accustomed to. Here, the lieutenant then had to take over here and take over his quartermaster CSM and everything, pending the arrival of another European from Calabar, which was on the way. That was all right, but anyway, in the meantime, the lieutenant had to take over and be responsible for that. So I had to hand over to the lieutenant, which was very good. And then now with my personal loads and my boy, I had to retrace my steps through the 4 days' walk to Atakpo. I said cheerio. Said cheerio to this mission chappy. On my way home, to Zaria, to Atakpo, I was able to see Captain Money again just for a short time, and then take the train up to Zaria. This was a very interesting. This was what we call the train that went from Enugu to Kaduna Junction. The train that twice a week it used to come from Port Harcourt right up. So this was the mail train, and on that there was a buffy. No problem with food or rushing to get water from the engine driver. Everything was on there, and there was just a question of sleeping in the carriage on the way up. That again, it was very interesting. Here, me travelling hundreds of miles up now, seeing the changing landscape from bush country, country, the hills around Caffin Chan and all this. These are all names, but to me, I can visualise the country even. It was very interesting. You came to McCurdy. Now, at this time, they were still building the bridge over the River Benue. It wasn't open until 1932. I could see in the trees them busy, the girders and everything being built. We didn't have time because when arrived at this bank on the River Benue, it was then shunted into three parts onto ferry, and then those three sections of the train were ferried across the river, which was half a mile wide or something like that, and then up on the other side on the railway to carry on with the next journey up to Caffin Chan or to Kaduna. But that was the most interesting thing. It was the only time that I saw the train ferry. But next time, the bridge was built and opened in 1932. It's a road and rail bridge combined, which was quite an achievement. Anyway, so that was most interesting from my point of view. Again, and European travelling, and got to Caffin Chan.
Did you travel first class on these occasions?
Yes, all Europeans travelled first, second class, and that was all Africans. But it was fascinating, Africans, how they pile in with all the baggage they've got and how on earth they squeeze into their compartments is nobody's business. But and fascinating, and the stops again, the market atmosphere and the chatter and everything, and the foodstuffs that was being sold. At Caffin, the driver turned out to be a Scot. So many of them were anyway in the railway, and he took over the train, and believe it or not, was a in the gardens with me. His name was McHattie. I'll never forget it. And we were most amazed. Came along. There was any European in. Came along the train when we were shunted up, ready to carry on our journey. And there was a European on. And as soon as we met. He came from Huntly, which was only 9 miles from my hometown in Keith. It's incredible, really. And his brother was... there was a link straight away, so I was able to break the journey by going up and when at appropriate times and be up in the engine with him and enjoy the view from travelling on an engine. And of course, again, I was able later on in the time to spend a little bit of local leave with him down in Caffin Chan, which was where he was stationed. So then we carried on. It was hundreds of miles, and we came to Kaduna. As soon as we arrived at Kaduna, which was the headquarters, Europeans came, BNCOs came down because they knew there was a European in the train going to Zaria. Zaria is another sort of roughly 50 miles, 100 miles farther on from Kaduna. But by this time it was night time, you see, when we got into Kaduna. And a couple of European BNCOs came down, made themselves known, and saw that everything was all right. And of course, we were able to have a drink and so on like that, and made contact that way. Then I arrived in Zaria, which was early next morning. I only had my personal loads. So this officer came and met me. It was my commanding officer to be, Major Cornish, very fine man too. He arrived because I didn't know who was going to meet me, but here was the commanding officer himself, which I didn't know he was the commanding officer because he was in civvies, you know, evening dress sort of thing. He introduced himself and said, "Right, oh, jump in the car." He said, "There's a couple of boys. Two soldiers here will take all your loads up. They know exactly where to go, and take your boy up to your house." He said, "You're coming straight to my house to just have a settling in, a cup of tea or something, and a little chat to give you time to get settled in." So I was immediately taken to his house, and there was a drink available, of course, and he then introduced me properly, and said he welcomed me to the Zaria. He was in charge of the depot. And he then told me straight away, he said, "Look," he said, "you are, it's very unheard of for a first tour man to come here." He said, "I'm very pleased that you've come." He said, "I know your record." He said, "The main thing is now you've reached." And man, this is 2 o'clock in the morning, these things, but I never forget it because he was a nice, he said, "Starting from tomorrow, Every afternoon, you've got to learn the language. He said, I've got a Sergeant Muzasara who is going to be your instructor. But he said, that's for on today. But in the meantime, we'll go well with you, but you'll get know all the ropes tomorrow. So straight from the word, I was told I'd get on with the language. Anyway, it was then my boy and one of the soldiers came, lead me to my house where I had to settle the day. And next morning, of course, I reported in officially to the commanding officer, met the sergeant major, given what was going to happen. Now, it was a very interesting in those days, sir, and an NCO from each battalion. So there you had four officers and four NCOs, again on thief and illness. But the thing was, the officer and the NCO came from the Union Concern, responsible for the training of their own recruits that were going to the battalion, and mine was the 3rd Battalion. So the onus, you see, the responsibility of recruits arrived in the battalion and they weren't up on standard, you were in the soup. You got a rocket from the commanding officer in the 3rd Battalion. So therefore you were your mettle from the word go that your recruits that you were going to train were going to be the best as possible. And the awards of recruits at different stages all the time. One leaving to join the battalion, the next one was coming up, the next one was at a later stage, and there was the new recruits coming in to start off their initial training. So this was the system. And it was very interesting.
Did the recruits come to Itasaria?
Yes, they came from all over Nigeria, and they were then allocated to the squads concerned. And that was the men, as I say, from all the various outstations. And of course, there was always a waiting list in Zaria. They were waiting on the outskirts, ready to be at any minute's notice. This was all done off record, as one would say. Yeah, there was people sort of like queuing up to come into the army.
So you had no difficulty getting recruits.
There was no difficulty, and they were being vetted all the time by the African sergeant major and everything. They were handpicking who they would have for recruit.
So these people would live outside.
Nothing to do with the army at all. They were living in the village in Zaria, but came up every day on the off getting in the army. And all the time they were weighing up and up practicing drill beforehand. So they were in a way, you see. And another system, you see, also they were also being using X, you see. So exactly, they were being sort of tripped off. They were being used for doing various jobs in barracks, sweepers, and things like that, cutting grass. And which the recruits didn't have time for, because we were responsible for getting them fully. Now, it was very interesting, because there we had these Africans from all over, all different tribes, different customs, and that. So that you were training them from the very beginning, and it was very valuable. Now, in my case, of course, again, I had to learn the language, because I didn't speak Hausa. And this, to me, was one of the most interesting parts of my life. Now, every afternoon, from 2 o'clock to 4 o'clock, there was no work done in barracks. It was too hot, especially up in Zaria. But the Africans, of course, they did all the cleaning of equipment and all this sort of thing, you see. But there was no parades. When I say there was no parades as such as drill parades. So Europeans then were free either to go to bed if they wanted to, but usually you were doing again your admin work, your paperwork and things like that. Well, in this case, in my case, I had just be in my veranda. This African sergeant came and he sat down in the veranda, and we just sat in the cool of the veranda, and I had to start learning the language. I had a smattering, got a little bit, because listening to words do. All words of command were in English, by the way. Everything was in English. Words of command were in English. But instruction had to be in the language, if you see what I mean. Anyway, but then I had this Sergeant Muzasara. Now, he was a Fulani. He spoke Arabic, he spoke Hausa, and he could speak French, because he came from right up on the edge of the Sahara originally. Spoke English very well. And various other languages. He was also a Malam. Now I'm coming back again to Malam. He was a Mohammedan. And he was a Malam. And to him, I owe an awful lot for the many afternoons that we sat and talked. Really amazing. Now, this is what I found. Once you started to try and learn the language, you were helped in every way by all the Africans. They saw that you were interested. It applied to me, it applied to every European that was interested. But I never forget it, because in this case, as the CEO said, you've got to pass your language in the next couple of months, your language test, and you've got to get on with it. Because he said, otherwise I can't keep you, sort of thing, you know. Anyway, this was really was him pushing me on. But thanks to Sergeant Mozasara, who was a most interesting chap, and he had about 16 years service by this time, and so every afternoon, if you can picture me sitting there with him, and I never knew what was going to happen, he would ask me all sorts of things in English, and I had to translate it and bring it into Hausa, and he guided me along the line. It was a wonderful experience. And so many simple things happened that really made me understand the African more than ever.
What sort of things?
Well, the African, you see, English, they didn't know the word, they didn't know English themselves. And you don't forget, you remember, we're dealing with recruits. And they, of course, every European's got a different way of speaking, and so on. And you make mistakes. We all do make mistakes. I made a lot of mistakes in my early days, and Africans don't like to be sworn at. And you have to be very careful. I did know that, but all the same, there was a general term when you say bushman. Well, it depends how you say it, and it can sound to somebody who doesn't know English, and it doesn't sound very nice. It's one of these things that I learned very early on, and it was thanks to Mozasara. This afternoon I came in, as I say, he came in, and we started off. So he said, in English, perfect English. Now, a great expression is kalasaji. You're not a sergeant, you're called a kalasaji. In the Africans, you're not really a colour sergeant, but it was another sort of a term. You're better than a sergeant, so you're always colour sergeant. So Sergeant Mozasara said, look, he said, look, there are other sergeants. He said, there's sergeant, there's you. You speak different from Sergeant so-and-so. He was an Irishman, it happened. There was another sergeant, was a Welshman. And there was another sergeant, I'll tell you this now because I must bring it in, because to me it was comical of how English, his name was Sergeant Pentecost. I've never come across the name again. He was in the West Kents, and he had the MM from World War I. His name was Pentecost. Now, that name, Pentecost, you see, Kalasaji Pentecost, to an African, was quite a mouthful. And the way they overcame that, he was known as Pound Tokos. Now, pound is abbreviation of pound, the English pound, money pound. Tokos is 8. So he was universally known as Kalasaji 8 pounds.
Why was that?
Well, his name was Pound Pentecost, you see. But you see, the Hausa is Pound Tokos. And that was the only way they could overcome the word Pentecost. So he was universally known as Kalasaji Pound Tokos. So here was Sergeant Mozasara saying to me, now, there's you're all these sergeants, you all speak different. Tell me about your country, England. You see, it was always England. That was where they got classified, England. That was, as far as they were concerned, that was where the King of England lived, and it was England, you see. So I had to think out how I could put all this over in Hausa to express what my country was and other than that. Anyway, I worked it out that the only way I could do it was to apply it to Nigeria. So briefly, in England, in English, I'll say how I put it over. So I said, right, Yoruba, that was Lagos, Abadan, and all that part of the country. I said, Yoruba, all the Yoruba country is like England. I beg your pardon, is like Wales. And so that will classify as Wales. Take all the remainder of the country, the eastern provinces, Calabar, Port Harcourt, right up as far as Kaduna, all the various tribes there, that comes under the heading of England. So that covered quite a bit of the country, as you can see. Then I said, now you take from over in the Bornu province, which is Maiduguri, all around that area, the Bornu province is like Ireland. Now, I was very proud of myself here, I thought, which of course included all the northern states. I said, now you take all the remainder of the country, which is all the Hausa country and all the various other tribes from here right up to the north, is like Scotland. That's my country. I'm from the north. I'm a Northman, you see. And I felt very proud of myself, you see. And then, in most perfect English, he looked at me, but I could see there was a twinkle in his eye, and he said, I could call you a bush Englishman. And I looked at him, and it suddenly clicked that I had used the word bushman to one of the recruits that was one of his countrymen. Just in that flash, I knew exactly. I was guided, call it what you like, coincidence, anything like that. I don't know why, but this was what happened. And straight away, I realized, and I looked at him, and I apologized to him. I knew exactly what he was getting at. And I never used that term from then onwards. If I was wanting to be rude to an African soldier, I used it in the way that they used to use them.
How was that?
Well, you were a fair enough. You called him a monkey, he knew what a monkey was. You could get round being, I don't want to be rude, but you could make your point without using other words. And that was one of my first introductions of being respecting Africans.
Did you find that other European NCOs respected the Africans?
Oh yes, yes. You got a feeling. There's one of these things that if you you did. Well, it grew. If you learned the language, now the Africans were most helpful. As I said earlier on, if they saw that you were interested, they were all out to help you. Now, what you found was, you said a thing to an African. You may give him an order in Hausa. The African immediately repeated that. And he wasn't being rude, he was repeating that for twofold reasons. A, so that you could hear what it should be, and if it was the correct way of saying it. So therefore you tuned in straight away. This was the way of helping you. They immediately repeated that order because there are so many words, according to how you say it, means a different thing. And this is where you then talked as you felt. This was the whole idea. And one of their expressions is you talk with your heart. Your heart means a lot in African life. And that's how you feel. So therefore, if you're happy, you've got to speak happy. And this was my introduction to the language. And starting from there, from being put, as I say, quite rightly in my place, very nicely, by a most understanding African man who was really a wonderful chap. He did a lot for me. I hope I'm not going on too long like that. Anyway, this is the sort of thing that happens. So from there, I was given a very polite lesson to respect Africans, respect their feelings, respect their charms, or jujus as we used to call them, respect the religion, and so on like that, which this man taught me.
Did you have any trouble with things like jujus with your new recruits?
Having been shown the right way, we usually left that for the African sergeants to do. Because Africans, they wear a lot of charms, and of course there were really too many for military life. So we left it to them to decide which was the best charms for them to keep. Because, you see, they got in the way. They had these leather things with various charms all round. And they're most interesting. And they mean an awful lot to them.
What sort of charms were they?
Well, they're usually made from the dried leaves, certain leaves from their, whatever their witch doctor, or whatever you like to call them, described. They used to make them up, cover them with leather, and they were very important. The Mohammedan ones were very important too. There was one that we never that was called a Baban Guru, if I remember right from memory now. That was the first charm that all Mohammedans had. And what it was, the melon, you would go to get this, your first charm. I'll call it charm, but it's really the earth part. And the malam would look at you and sum you up, and he would write an extract from the Quran on this piece of paper, and really like an extract from the Bible, the Old Testament, a text like from the Bible sort of thing. Anyway, that was written on with ink on this bit of paper. He would then hand it to you, and you licked it. And then you were sort of imbibing the word of Allah into your system, as you would say, by licking that off and saying whatever it was, you see. And then that piece of paper, you then folded over into as small a bit as possible, and then you covered it, or got somebody else to cover it for you in leather, and that was your first and your most important charm, which was very important. And so were other charms, but that was by the way. But I wanted to mention that, to see, we had, now I mentioned about various tribes. Now in Zaria we had, again, this was essential, there was a book with all the tribes, northern tribes of Africa in particular, had been compiled. It hadn't been very long compiled, through the experiences of all the district officers over the years on the various tribes. And that was compiled into a big volume, which we had to read up so that we could get a background to where these various Africans came from and the tribal customs, which was most important to know. Little did I know that within a few short time I would be involved in that, which I'll explain just in a minute. But we had that to do. We also had a staff list showing you where all the different stations were for the district officers, for the provinces and so on like that, so that if any of our Africans had any complaints or worries on anything, we were able to write straight to the station concerned. At least I say we, the officer did it for you, but I mean you compiled everything, that was your job, and it was sent to the district officer. He would then find out what was happening, perhaps the parents were